You're listening to The Ragged Edge. I'm Richard Stone.
And Starship, as you alluded to, sort of being this science fiction come into real life, is a revolutionary system. I mean, what they are trying to do in terms of the cost, size, reuse of that vehicle is something we've never seen before.
For anyone who knows me, it's no secret that I'm a huge fan of science fiction. And as such, I listened to the Gemini mission broadcast on my transistor radio when I was a kid and glued myself to the television when Neil Armstrong first set foot on the moon. Our family toured the Johnson Space Center in Houston whenever we got the chance. We held an early morning watch party for the shuttle's first space launch and watched as many of the launches as I could. It seems that over the last year or so, the tempo of our activities in low Earth orbit, you know, the talk of another mission to the moon, like in the next 4 years, and eventually to Mars, has rekindled my interest. Man, this is the stuff of science fiction. So I invited Eric Berger to the show to talk about it all. Eric is the senior space editor at Ars Technica, covering everything from astronomy to private space ventures to wonky NASA policy. And he is the author of the book Liftoff, about the rise of SpaceX. That's Elon Musk's efforts to send humans to Mars. Eric was at the Houston Chronicle for 17 years, where the paper was a Pulitzer Prize finalist in 2009 for his coverage of Hurricane Ike. Here's that conversation. Eric Berger, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Richard.
Hey, there's a lot of stuff going on in space right now. I read your book, and then I asked you to be on the podcast. And between the time you said yes and today, there's been an awful lot of like launches and all kinds of stuff. And the reason that I brought you on is, one, to talk about your book, which is the early days of SpaceX. But then SpaceX went out there this week and or last week and just kind of killed it between the Starship launch and landing and the 10th mission of a Falcon 9 booster. That's pretty incredible. It seems kind of like the science fiction that Robert Heinlein promised us is here. I see that Starship and it's just like, that's exactly what we were promised back in the day.
I would say a couple things about that, Richard. First of all, it's remarkable also what they're doing just sort of at a baseline perspective with the Falcon 9 rocket.
Right.
Because in April, we saw another launch of crew. So this was the third crew launch that SpaceX has done for NASA now. So they put 10 humans into space. And we also had a landing then of the Crew Dragon vehicle. So we'll talk about the future in just a second, but I just want to point out that like, at the present, they're like NASA's most important provider of cargo and crew services to the International Space Station. That is the main program that NASA has flying right now. So like they're meeting NASA's most important needs right now with the Falcon 9 and Crew Dragon. But you're right. They've gone ahead and pushed beyond what NASA had asked them for in terms of, you know, making the Falcon 9 reusable. And the fact that they've flown one of those stages 10 times is really amazing. And so that's sort of like the bread and butter and of their business, and also the precursor, because what really enables Starship is the fact that it will be reusable. And so they're taking these lessons that they've learned from the Falcon 9 rocket. Now they've flown that rocket more than 100 times, landed it about 80 times. And so they really have figured out a lot of things about how you get a rocket back, you know, what condition is it in coming back from, you know, above 100 kilometers at such high velocities? How can you harden the rocket to make it more reusable? How can you lower the time and cost of refurbishing it? And they're putting all those lessons learned into Starship, which is this massive vehicle that they're assembling in South Texas and hope to make that the truly revolutionary launch system, because it's large and the hope is for that they could turn around and fly within days of launching it.
Yeah. One of the pieces of news that's come out in the last couple of weeks is that NASA chose SpaceX to provide the moon lander, right, for their return to the moon in 2022. Is that correct?
2024.
And of course, in the meantime, the other players who were bidding against that have managed to kind of put a quietus on that for at least for now. But if SpaceX continues the way they're going, they may go to the moon anyway.
That was always the plan. So you're right. Last month, actually on April 16th, NASA awarded SpaceX a contract to build the lunar lander for its Artemis program to go back to the moon. And that surprised pretty much everyone in the space community, because Starship, the SpaceX proposal to do that, is so revolutionary. They figured that maybe they would pick SpaceX and one of the other bidders. But NASA said, we only have a limited amount of money. SpaceX has the most technically ready solution, and it's for the lowest amount of money. And it's the only one we can afford. So we're going to press ahead with Starship. That was significant, because you're right. SpaceX is moving ahead with Starship regardless. The NASA funding will help. It was $2.9 billion, but it wasn't essential. And
wow, I got to interrupt you. Their $2.9 billion wasn't essential. That to me speaks an awful lot about what SpaceX is doing. Just that one statement, that it wasn't essential to what they're doing.
So what you're saying is, you're right. Another really attractive feature of SpaceX's bid as part of the human landing system is that they are really self-investing in Starship, mm-hmm. meaning that they're hoping the government will pay some of the cost, but they're paying the bulk of the cost to develop Starship. That was not the case with the Blue Origin-led team and the Dynetics-led team. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Reading your book, which is a fascinating read, by the way, at a 30,000-foot level, I've kind of paid attention to what SpaceX has done because I thought it was kind of cool, but I didn't get into the nitty-gritty details until very, very recently. And it's interesting to me that at one point, it was a NASA contract that actually saved SpaceX at the end of the Falcon 1 or near the end of the Falcon 1 program. Musk was just going to, Falcon, the third launch or maybe the fourth launch, if that didn't actually go through, he was at a point that he was broke. He was right there on the edge of bankruptcy. And then and then there was the launch, and it was successful. And there you go. I think almost the rest is history after that.
Yeah, there were really two key moments in 2008 that could have broken the company. The first was, as you mentioned, the fourth launch of the Falcon 1 rocket. So this was the first rocket they were trying to build. It was a small one, had just a single Merlin engine in the first stage. But even building a small rocket is insanely difficult, because so many things have to go right and only one thing can go wrong, and they had failed three times previously. And so the first thing they had to do was get that rocket to orbit. And as I write about in the book, there were all sorts of challenges with that final one. It was really quite a harrowing 8-week period right before the launch. But ultimately they did succeed with that launch at the end of September. At that point, the company still was not saved, because since they had failed so often, they didn't have a long list of customers that were going to pay them to fly on the Falcon 1. And so they still needed money, and Musk couldn't provide it anymore, because he'd put all of his money into SpaceX and then Tesla, and both companies essentially were on the brink of going bankrupt. And so it was a contract 3 days before Christmas in 2008 from NASA to deliver cargo to the International Space Station that did save the company.
I'm not sure I realized how close that came. And then once that occurred, then I'm not going to say it was all roses and light after that. You don't get too much into what happened after that in the book. A little bit in kind of the epilogue where you talk about, okay, well, this character's doing this now and this individual's doing this now. And I didn't really intend this to be a complete show about SpaceX, although that's what your book is about, because there's a lot of other stuff also working to the commercialization of space. But there is something different about the way Musk has approached his company and the other companies, and you call them, some of them legacy companies and some of them are patterned on legacy companies, if you will. He's not afraid to burn money.
Right. So one of the goals I had with this book was, I've written about space for more than a decade now, and SpaceX is clearly the most disruptive, transformative company in that industry. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to go back and understand why they were successful, because a lot of other people had come along and tried to do what SpaceX did in terms of building the first liquid fueled, orbital rocket privately. Mm-hmm. They had all failed. So I want to understand why SpaceX succeeded and what made them special, stand out in this industry. And so that was really the purpose of the book. And it covers just the first 6 years, because I think there's a pretty nice narrative in that adventure, the Falcon 1 adventure. But all of the seeds for their success were laid down, planted in those first years. And really it does go back to Musk, and he had enough money, about $100 million that he put into SpaceX. But he also worked really, really hard to hire the best possible people to run the company. His human resources director told me that Musk personally hired the first 3,000 engineers at SpaceX.
Wow.
Which takes a lot of time Because he has a pretty unique, interviewing style that can be pretty intense. So he's very good at finding smart people and then motivating them.
And then keeping them. And then also keeping them to some degree.
Well, so, I mean, some do leave. I mean, it's an extremely demanding work environment. So how do you keep them while they're working under this intense amount of stress? And so he's good at motivating them, whether through a mix of fear, incentive or so forth, but it works because if you're a young, talented engineer and you go to SpaceX, you know you're going to make a difference, right? You're not, if you go somewhere else, you know, not anything bad about NASA or Lockheed or Boeing or any of those places, but if you go there, you are going to be one of many, and there's going to be a lot more bureaucracy and a lot more paper pushing, a lot less working and on hardware and testing it. Because one thing SpaceX does, is, as we've seen with the Starship program in South Texas, is they don't wait around and try to engineer the hell out of these vehicles. They're going to build them, fly them, blow them up, see what failed, fix that, and then fly it again. And that's really one of the key innovations that he brought into the aerospace industry, to bring this back around your question, is he has this iterative design method. I think that he learned, you know, when writing software at the beginning of his career, where basically you build something, you run the code, you see what breaks, and then you fix that and you go again. And so it was this willingness to fail in spectacular ways that I think really set him apart from a lot of the other space companies.
Yeah. I've read a couple of stories, some of yours, some of your colleagues who say something to the effect of Elon loves blowing stuff up. And it's kind of spectacular when you watch some of, particularly some of the Starship launches, which I've watched several of them. Some of those are spectacular. If you like to see things blow up, they're absolutely spectacular.
I don't know if it's so much wanting to see things blow up or loving to see it, although it is a great show. And I think it's part of their marketing. But I think the general sense is if they're not blowing stuff up, then they're not pushing hard enough, right? They're not taking the risks that are necessary to build a revolutionary system if they're just sort of fly it safely the first time out. And Starship, as you alluded to, sort of being this science fiction come into real life, is a revolutionary system. I mean, what they are trying to do in terms of the cost, size, reuse of that vehicle is something we've never seen before. And hopefully they pull it off, because it really would change spaceflight as we know it better.
I did take the time to watch the SN15 launch and then landing. Do you think he was surprised that it landed successfully?
No, I think he'd expected the one before to land and was disappointed when it didn't. And so, you know, quite frankly, they needed to land this one because they had tried four times before to do it. And you know, at some point, spectacular failures turn into just failures. And so you need to show progress. And so they showed significant progress, which was important, I think.
Yeah, they did. I read somewhere, maybe again, someplace on Twitter, that they didn't really have a way to take SN15 off the pad because they'd never done it before and they didn't really expect it to happen. So, but now it's back up on the pad, and I keep hearing they're going to launch it again.
Well, they've got two orbital platforms two launch platforms that they can use. And you're right, they did lift SN15 onto one of them. I think they're inspecting it now. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that they've made the decision of whether it's flight worthy again, but if it is, they go through and they, you know, check the stresses on the tanks and the engines and structure and decide that everything looks okay. They will fly it again. I think I'm a little skeptical that it'll be flight worthy, but you know, we'll find out probably in the days or weeks ahead.
Yeah. That's going to be interesting to see if that happens. So for the future, it is very likely that SpaceX will be one of the landers. I mean, Blue Origin or Dynetics may come in, because I hear there's some legislation in Washington right now that's going to require NASA to offer another contract to somebody else, just to have the redundancy, if nothing else.
Yeah.
But Musk has said many, many times that his goal is Mars. You talk about that in the book, that he talks about that the Falcon 1 was really just the first step to getting us to Mars. And somebody quoted him recently as saying, well, we originally wanted to go to Mars by 2022, but we could probably get there by 2024. Now, I don't know whether that was musing or somebody was putting words in his mouth, but the idea that here I am 65, watched the first shuttle launch with all my family and friends gathered around me, watched the first landing on the moon with all my family around me, been a science fiction fan forever, that we could actually get to Mars in my lifetime is a little, I'd lost hope that that might happen. Mars. Do you have anything to say about that?
First of all, it's incredibly difficult. The challenge of going to Mars is an order of magnitude more difficult than the moon. That's why we haven't tried it, because it is just this difficult undertaking. And I think SpaceX and Blue Origin, for that matter, but only SpaceX is really executing, have the right of it in that if we really want to mount a sustainable mission to the moon or Mars, you need a low cost launch system to get a lot of material into low Earth orbit and then go from there. And so that's why building large reusable rockets is the key first step. And now we're starting to see that. And so Starship is the kind of architecture that you could use for a Mars mission. There's no way it's going to happen in 2024. And I'd be deeply skeptical of it happening in the 2020s. However, I'm 48. And if SpaceX did not exist, then I would not think that the humans were going to Mars in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. But SpaceX does exist. And NASA has had this partnership with them since 2006, and it's grown and grown and grown. And now we're seeing NASA is going to be working with SpaceX to land humans on the moon. And so that means they're going to help them human rate the Starship vehicle, which is a huge step. And so now it's not too difficult to see a world in which NASA and SpaceX combine to work on a transportation system to go to Mars. And that's super important, not just because of funding, which NASA has, but because NASA spent 20 years working on the International Space Station, more than 20 years, sort of understanding closed loop environmental systems. So like you recapture your water after you drink it and reuse it. How do you keep astronauts alive for 6 months in space and microgravity? These are all things that SpaceX needs to know how. And so you could see a mission to Mars. I think the earliest conceivable date for me would be 2030. But I do think it will happen in my lifetime. And it's, you know, we're sort of have seen a progression where year by year, it seems to become a little bit more realistic.
Okay. So I got to hang on for 10 more years, you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah, you can do it.
It'll be fine. It'll be fine. But enough about space. Let's talk about the weather. That's where I first started following you, by the way, was around Hurricane Harvey. I published a small newspaper up here in Central Texas, and we were following Harvey very, very closely. We had people going down that way. And somehow I stumbled on, Space City Weather on Facebook. And I've been following Space City Weather on both Facebook and Twitter ever since. And it's only recently, probably in the last 6 months or a year, that I realized you were Space City Weather and also Space Guy, one and the same. Your weather reports are fascinating. And part of why I follow it is because it's not hysterical and it's sometimes kind of dry and funny. And I don't see that with other. Where did you get into weather?
I have an astronomy background. So I've always been interested in space. I got to Houston in 1997 and bought a house in the spring of 2001 near White Oak Bayou. And that June, Tropical Storm Allison hit the Houston region. And this was an enormous flood storm. And I had been actually at a nightclub that night when it hit. It caught me unawares. And you could hear the rain pounding on the roof of the nightclub over the music. Bob Schneider was playing at a club in Houston on Washington Avenue. And it rained so hard that night, I couldn't get home. I tend to where I lived. And so I ended up tramping around in the rain all night. Cause I just pulled my car over on a meeting and I linked back up with my friends and it was just like, kind of like, wow, this is wild. I was in my 20s at the time. And, after that event and, you know, where the water came up right to the front door of my house, I realized I had a lot to learn about tropical weather and I didn't want to be caught unawares. And so I started writing more about weather, for the Houston Chronicle. I was a science writer there. And then we got hit by Hurricanes Rita and Katrina hit, you know, New Orleans and sent a bunch of evacuees towards Houston. Then Hurricane Ike struck the Houston region. So I went back and got a meteorology certification from Mississippi State University. And so I became a meteorologist so I could write a little bit more authoritatively. And, you know, when I left the Chronicle in 2015 to cover space for Ars Technica, I just kept a weather website because some people had appreciated what I'd done at the Chronicle. I didn't expect it to blow up like it did.
Guys, if you're not following it, it's one of the best weather forecasts. And it doesn't really have an impact on Central Texas, although it kind of does the way you do your forecasts. But it is positively fascinating. So normally about this point in the interview, I'll ask you questions like, what is the one thing you're never going to do again? So what is the one thing you're never going to do again?
Boy, I don't know. You know, hopefully working in an office again. When I left the Chronicle, I worked from home, wrote from home, and I've been doing it for 5.5 years. And so it's been interesting to me over the last year with the pandemic to see how, you know, when half of the world started working from home, kind of the reaction of people, mm-hmm. you know, good and bad to that experience. Because it's for me, it's been enormously positive to be able to work from a home office. So I would say the one thing I hope to never do is have to go in like 9 to 5 and work in an office. I think I work harder mm-hmm. than I did before, but it's much more enjoyable.
Yeah. And you get fewer interruptions than you do when you're in an office environment. So what's next? And that could be, you can take that any way you want to.
Yeah. A couple answers. First of all, from a practical standpoint with Space City Weather, we're releasing an app for the first time in about a month. And that's like a big thing for us because we're a small site and it's not cheap to develop an app and it's pretty cool. But a lot of people have asked for it. So I'm excited about that. And more generally, I mean, the space program and what's happening in space just is becoming more and more engaging because you've got not just NASA and China and the European Space Agency and sort of the governmental agencies, but there's just been this really flourishing of commercial activity. And so there's lots and lots of things happening in space. And so that it's really never been a more exciting time, I think, to be involved in or following the field just because there's so much happening. You know, SpaceX and Starship are the most visible, but there's a lot of stuff happening underneath that as well.
Thank you for taking the time out of your schedule. I know you're real busy right now. I had no idea when you said, hey, it looks like it's going to be about another 10 days or 2 weeks before we can get together, that it was covering all of that stuff that SpaceX was doing until I tuned into the news and went, oh, no, and have been trying to educate myself on it and failing miserably because it's just like a fire hose. There's just so much going on. And
that's right.
I can't even follow SpaceX, much less Blue Origin and Dynetics and the United Launch Systems. And I've got more words now than I know than I can actually define or I know the definition.
It's a full-time job trying to stay up on top of the industry. And even for me, it's like, it almost seems like it's too much anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, good luck to you. And maybe I'll see you at Boca Chica later.
Sounds good, Richard. Let's hope for a quiet hurricane season.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thanks, Eric.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I'd like to thank my guest, Eric Berger. You can follow Eric on Twitter at SciGuySpace or on Facebook at Space City Weather. Thanks for listening. See you next time. A reminder, you can help people find The Ragged Edge when you rate and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever it is you found it. And please share it with your friends so we can build our audience. The Ragged Edge is a production of RTS Connect, helping public-facing organizations make their point, then stay on point. Info at rtsconnect.org. Original theme music composed and performed by Ryan Stone. Hey, thanks, man. Thanks for listening to The Ragged Edge. See you next week.